Oh, Baba, we don't hear you.
That's okay, because I pressed mute. Come on, we're post-2020. One must be muted accidentally, right? Otherwise, it's not a true meeting. That's the rule now. Okay.
Hello out there, and welcome to this episode of the SUX podcast. We are here. Actually, I'm joined by Bavo today, my wonderful co-host, and we have a really wonderful guest because today we have Robert Cosma, or also known as Bob Cosma. And he's the author of the really wonderful book, Making the World a Better Place, Designed with Passion, Purpose, and Value. So good morning, Bob.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
And it's a real honor, actually, to have you as our guest here at the podcast. There are so many things we would like to ask and discuss with you, but well, we try to make it not too long. Sometimes we run really long, so we'll try our best. And so let's dive into and start with a few simple questions about you for our SUX friendship book. How does a perfect day begin for you?
Ah, okay. Well, I live in the city, have a place in the mountains as well, but a perfect day would actually be on a beach in the Caribbean. So setting out, reading a book in the shade, just looking out at the water, that would be great.
That sounds wonderful, actually, really.
Yeah, I would be in for that.
I guess, and that's a guess, I guess you have hundreds of wonderful books. Do you have a favorite book, a recommendation for all people out there?
Yeah, that's interesting. I used to go to the library all the time. I was a devoted library visitor. I haven't been to a library in years. And I used to have rows and rows, stacks of books that I personally owned. Now I have a handful. I have 700 books on my computer. Wow. And I find that kind of the best way to, I love holding a book and reading a book, but if I'm studying, it's so much better to do it on the computer. To answer your question though, I mean, there's so many books that I really appreciate and enjoy reading. But one that comes to mind that I'd like to share is Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith. Most people know Smith for his Wealth of Nations, but he was not just an economist. He was a moral a philosopher. So I really like that juxtaposition of these two books. Moral philosophy and economics, and we live in both these worlds, and it's interesting to kind of see these two worlds through Adam Smith's lens from the 18th century.
I found myself being more and more of a movie person as time progressed. Would you consider yourself a movie person, and do you have any favorite there?
Well, it's interesting. We just had, among our friends a couple days ago, had a watch party. And the movie was Being John Malkovich.
I love that movie.
Me too.
We had so much fun watching that. We had John Malkovich masks made. So at that famous point where John Malkovich goes down to the chute in his own brain and sees himself all over the place, we all were wearing John Malkovich masks.
That is a good detail.
Oh, great. You just reminded me I have to rewatch the movie. I watched it two or three times. And
It's so funky and delightful. And I mean, the other one more recent is Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I mean, it has that kind of same weird, kind of funky, comic feel to it.
I'm happy you say that, because when I watched it with my wife, I compared the two movies as well, as in, like, I'm getting a bit of a Being John Malkovich vibe here.
Coming coming from books and movies, well, since we want to talk about sustainability and the future, maybe that's a difficult question. What is sustainability for you?
Yeah, sustainability has, it's just such an important issue right now. As I mentioned, we have a place up in the mountains, and a couple of years ago, there were huge forest fires that required the evacuation of an entire town, large city. I mean, not large by city standards, but by in terms of that area, the largest city on the lake, Lake Tahoe, had the whole city had to be evacuated because this fire was kind of roaring through. Fortunately, the winds took a turn and the city escaped the fire. And there were no deaths, surprisingly, and thankfully. So it's something that I've thought a lot about, is climate change and the way that we're living in the world that has caused major changes that we're going to have to deal with for a long time. So sustainability is an important issue for me and for all of us, of course. And it's living in a way that allows the planet to continue such that we can all still live here. And that is going to require major changes in the way that we interact in our economy and the way that we live from day to day. It's an important issue for me.
So true. Speaking about sustainability and all its different aspects, actually, there are the Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations. And is there maybe one or two that bring out the strongest passion in you that are, well, maybe not the most important, but in your feeling or for you?
Well, the real big one for me is Sustainability Goal 4, which is quality education for all. I started my career as a primary school teacher and was a university professor and so on. So education, of course, is really important for me. But more important than that is that education is a way that we all become enabled to make a difference in the world. In fact, one of the principles in my book, one of the design principles, is advanced knowledge and agency with our designs. So it's really by increasing our knowledge and our agency, our ability to use that knowledge, that we can each make a difference in the world.
I agree. No, education is where most of our problems can be fixed. I feel like I keep coming back to that. Like, how do we fix that problem? Well, by educating the next generation to do better.
Yeah.
And educating the current generation to change.
Do better than we have.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to doing better, sustainability is an interesting topic to talk about, which is part of the reason why we have this podcast. But we also realize that we're all flawed as humans, and therefore we all have we call them guilty pleasures. Even though we're all passionate about sustainability, I mean, I don't think anyone on this podcast or any guest that appears here isn't. But we're always wondering, do you have any guilty pleasures where you, for some, it's I stream too much Netflix. For others, it's I love taking long showers because that's my little guilty pleasure. Do you have any?
Well, ice cream would be towards the top, but it's my guilty pleasure is getting wild and crazy. I'm used to being very, proper as a university professor and so on. But kind of my other side is to go to a party and get wild and crazy. Actually, later this summer, I'm going to go out to the desert for Burning Man. And if your passion is to get wild and crazy, I advise you to go to Burning Man at least once in your lifetime. So it's quite an experience and one that I really enjoy.
Cool. Yeah. So moving on, we recently saw a conversation between you and Don Norman on LinkedIn, where you both had read each other's books, which was really funny and interesting to see how you reacted to each other's books. And one thing that stuck with us was the quote, "Well, I read the one book after the other one, and it felt like I read my own." And I think it's Don Norman who then says, "Well, the books are not redundant. That's the beauty of it. They complement each other, the two." And I honestly had the same feeling when I read them. It also makes me want to immediately dive into the motivation. So what drove you to write this book?
Yeah, that's an important question, because I'm retired. I could just be sitting out on a beach in the Caribbean. But writing this book was a very personal, very passionate kind of endeavor for me. And it was motivated by something that my father told me. In fact, I cite this on the first page of the book. Something that motivated me is what my father said when I was a young man. He said, "Whatever it is that you do, leave the world a better place than you found it." And I've always tried to live my life and work in my career with that idea in mind. So when I retired, I wondered what it was that I could do. And there are, things that I volunteered for and so forth. But there were a lot of ideas that I had about making the world a better place. I've written a lot of academic pieces, journal articles, book chapters, and so on. But I wanted to speak more to designers. I've always thought of myself as a designer going way back, and I can talk about that. But I feel designers make an important contribution to the world. There are ways that we can think about design that make the world a better place. And that was really the motivation of the book, to help designers think more specifically about making the world better.
Hey, and that's why we are so happy to have you as our guest, because that's exactly one of the drivers for us in the Sustainable UX Network, that we say, hey, we have a lot of power and responsibility, right? And we can make an impact. But speaking about designers, and when we looked at the website, you have a website for your book, and when you look at the website, I think one of the very first sentences says, "We are all designers." So what is design for you, and why are we all designers?
Yeah, well, that's an important question. The approach that I took was quite broad, is quite broad. Normally we think of design in very narrow ways. So there are user experience designers, there are web designers, there are graphic designers, fashion designers, software designers. We think of design in these kind of narrow silos of specialization, special techniques, special criteria for evaluating designs. My approach is much broader. I draw on Nobel laureate Herb Simon and his book Sciences of the Artificial for my definition of design, which is, as Simon would say, anyone is designing who is engaged in activities who take us from where we are to a preferred state. So that has a lot of implications to it. It defines design as a process, and a process that makes change. So it's not an artifact I mean, we need artifacts, software, and products, and so on, to get from here to here. But all of us are engaged in one way or another in getting from here to here, getting to where it is that we prefer. So in that sense, we're all everyday designers. We're always thinking about how it is that we can change the world for the better, often for the better for us individually, personally. And the book is meant to get us to start thinking more about how it is that we can make changes to make a better world for everyone.
A thing I found that the book does so immensely well at the start is to point out the power that we have as designers and the capabilities that come with it. But as soon as that's done, it immediately starts talking and points out the responsibility that comes with it. And I feel, and if I you stated as well, is too often designers are not creating products, services, and others that make life better for the greatest amount of numbers. You've already mentioned it earlier, but we often design for 10% or even the top 1%. And then the rest is almost a comical amusement to keep the rest busy, is what it could feel like to some. How do you feel this is happened? We've gained this power, yet we forgot about this responsibility. Are we failing here as designers? Do you feel that?
Yeah, well, yes. designers and everybody else lives, if you're in the US or Europe, in a kind of particular economic context that we have to deal with one way or another. And our economy has moved in a direction that I think is creating a lot of problems and not solving a lot of others. And the driving force for this economy is to make money. Unfortunately, that precludes a lot of other important goals in the world. And I point to an important turning point. I mean, making money has always been an important part of the economy that we live in. But and Milton Friedman, who was also a Nobel laureate, had an article in the New York Times, which he called the Friedman Doctrine, which is that the only responsibility that corporations have is to their shareholders. And that responsibility is to make as much money as possible. But that was an important turning point because it drove policies in the US and Europe, primarily in England, with the Thatcher, Thatcher government, and in the U.S. with the Reagan government. It really turned our economies in a direction that kind of maximized money at the expense of everything else. And so we live in this economy, we work in this economy. And so for designers, it's kind of narrowed how it is that we think about design. Design is to make money. And so when you sit down and you think about, okay, what designs should I focus on in my job or my career, it really narrows it to mass consumption products. And even within that, to the products that would make the most money, which most often is done with people who have the most money. So you have, on one hand, a set of designs that are for this narrow segment, the top 10 or top 1, that you make a lot of money here, or on the other hand, you make a little bit of money, but with a lot of people. So it's Netflix or Facebook, mm-hmm. or, you know, that is really, I think, driving design right now.
True. And maybe speaking about, well, we were looking at design at a very, very broad level, as you said. And if we look at especially UX design, which are like Bavo and me are into, and I can tell for a long time, I always thought, okay, I'm one of the good guys because I'm not focusing on the business, but I'm focusing on the user. And here's a big but, actually, and because I saw a guy called Kevin Slevin many years ago. Actually, his talk was one of the drivers for me to go more into this whole sustainability direction. And he actually said, when designers center around the user, right, which seems to be something good, where do the needs and desires of the other actors in the system go, right? So, I made it connection to something you say in your book where you say happiness and not harm. And I think in UX and design, we focus so much on the user trying to do good for the user that we miss all the other actors in the system and all the implications of our products onto them, right? So, and maybe so the design process also has failed us, and maybe you have an opinion what needs to change to get better on this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes back to my previous answer that what is kind of driving the design process and everything else in our economy. But let me give you a specific example, which I think illustrates your point. And this, I attended a lecture that was given by a designer from an internationally known human-centered design studio. And he was talking about where it is that we get inspirations for our designs. And he was prompting us to think broadly about where we should do it. And he gave an example of a situation where someone got an idea for a design when traveling in West Africa. That they were looking at how it is that children in West Africa played. And there was a board on a log that one kid was using to balance and kind of playing with this log, with this board on a log. And inspired this guy to create a toy called Bongo Board, which was really quite popular some decades ago. So he was touting this as an example of human-centered design and inspiration in everyday things. And I said, but wait a minute, who was the designer here? Was it the guy who took this product and made a lot of money on it? Or was it these kids in West Africa, and did they benefit at all from this design, this product that he came up with? And it's interesting because this human-centered designer kind of stopped in his tracks and didn't realize what had happened here, is that the real designers, the kids that came up with this idea, didn't benefit at all from this product that the designer took away and commercialized. So his contribution was the monetization of this idea that these kids had and selling it to people in the United States and in Europe. So the problem is who it is that we're including in our thinking about designs. Mm-hmm. In this case, these kids were not included. They didn't benefit from the design that they came up with. There wasn't any kind of sharing of, there weren't any royalties, there wasn't sharing of profit for an idea that they had. So I think that this kind of narrow vision of looking at design as a way of making money has really kind of distorted our view of users and who should be considered when we're designing. So I think that in the book, what I advocate is designing with principles, not just users in mind, but how it is that we're going to design to make the world a better place. And having moral principles in mind that guide our designs, like doing no harm, reducing harm when we see it, increasing happiness and well-being, advancing knowledge and agency, and so on. Having these value principles in mind is really what's going to make a difference, I believe, in designs that just make money or designs that make the world a better place.
Wow. Yeah. I 100% agree, especially on the ethical compass part. We've had Trine Falber in our podcast a few episodes ago as well, who spoke of very similar ethical compasses to influence and decide on which project we should and should not actively participate in. She mentioned transparency as a very, very important part of how we do that. Do you have any process that you use into projects on how to ensure that everyone is included?
Yeah, there is an approach to the design that I advocate in the book, which I call a moral discourse among co-creators. That is, it's a moral discourse in the sense of being explicit about the values that are driving the design. And the values are not just mine as a designer. I mean, I do have values, and those drive my actions and my designs. But other people have values that differ from mine, even if we're talking about the same principle, but like increasing happiness and well-being. So your idea about what happiness is may be different than my idea about happiness. So in design, we need to talk about that and need to come to some shared understanding, which may be different for you and me, but that's kind of part of the challenge in how it is that we design, is resolving in one way or another these differences among people mm-hmm. in terms of values. So this idea is first kind of value-based, and it's also a discourse with co-designers. That is, I'm not just kind of going back to the design studio, kind of running a focus group, getting ideas, going back to the design studio, and then doing my thing. I'm including others in the design process, in the creative process, so that they're participants in both the generation of the ideas and ultimately the benefit that comes from those ideas as they're turned into design. So that's kind of the approach that I advocate in the book.
Very good point, actually, and that maybe directly leads to the next question I would like to ask you, because I think, and you touched that already, that everything we build, every product we build, every experience we work on, though we always look on the product or the experience, is always part of a bigger system, right? Of a bigger context. In the end, so many things are connected, and things we build sometimes, well, are part of a bigger system or rely on complex economical and governmental systems. So that's something you speak about in your book as well. And my question would be, how do we find our role as a designer here, or how can we maximize the impact that we can have, actually?
Yeah, that's a very important practical question. I mean, we can talk about values, we can talk about changing the world, but when it comes down to it, is what is it that we do individually as designers? I think that too often we as designers kind of give up our agency to the people that we work for. And that's when things kind of get derailed, because often those designs are driven by these kind of exclusively by these money-making considerations. I think we need to reclaim our power as designers, and that we can decide what it is that we're going to do as designers, what problems that we're going to solve, what designs that we're going to come up with. Making a living doing that, of course, is an important consideration. And I do talk about that in the book, in the last chapter, how it is that we can kind of live our lives as designers whose purpose we see as making the world better. And there are a number of suggestions that I have. One that I often point to when people ask me this question is an organization called 80,000 Hours. And in fact, it's 80,000, the numerals 8000.org, I believe. It could be .com. I think it's .org.
Yeah.
And what they have done, I mean, this is an important resource for those of us who are interested in making a difference. What they've done is to identify the most important kinds of changes that need to happen in the world, and point to jobs and companies and organizations that are actually working towards achieving these goals, solving these problems. So it's an important resource for people who want to make a difference, but don't want to create their own design studio or their own business so that they have more control over the designs that they make. They can work for organizations, some of them commercial, many of them nonprofit, that are actively working towards making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I've heard about 80,000 Hours. It is an amazing resource indeed. What I wanted to also talk about in one of the later chapters of the book, I can't exactly remember which one, you speak specifically about communities and groups, and how social media tried and kind of failed us in bringing us together. But you do mention specifically how it's important to build supportive relationships and communities. And as a community organizer, I'm very curious about what the answer is going to be on the following question. Why is it so important to you that we do these types of communities, or rather, as you mentioned it, we rediscover the power of a community?
Yeah. We're a social species. We're more like baboons than we are cheetahs. We collect together. We work together. We live together. And it's in our, literally in our DNA, and in our physical composition, there are electrochemical, processes that drive our social experiences, that start from the very beginning, when mothers and fathers hold babies. There is an electrochemical reaction that goes on inside the mother and inside the baby that create this experience that drives the continued relationship between mother and baby, father and baby, and then it develops through life. And it's those electrochemical experiences that really motivate us to reach out to other people. Now, of course, then there's a whole bunch of other aspects to social experiences that ripple through our lives that allow us to live in complex societies, to engage in economic activity, that these are all social arrangements. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what are the purposes of these arrangements other than having us feel good, which is an important aspect of that, of when we see a friend or a relative, there is this bodily feeling that we have. But how do we create something more than just that kind of bodily experience as a result of having social experiences? And it is kind of building this network, this community of people that we interact with and that we support that goes beyond mere economic transactions, where I sell you something, you buy something. That's a social experience, but it's merely transactional. It's merely we're trading. But how do we connect people in a deeper way that goes beyond just transactions and creates a community in which members are fulfilled as participants in that community? And there's something more created than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
And that's really what a community is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I usually explain it or try to explain it to people in the sense only together can we truly level up. Because individually, we don't have enough experience points, to put it in video game terms, to level to the next level. Only when we combine ours can we truly achieve something great.
Sure.
Yeah. And I think there's another great, for me, actually, connection to something you say at the, I think it's the very last chapter in your book where you say like that we are at a junction and that we have to choose, which we have this nice picture of the two roads we can choose, right? The more likely road or the road less traveled. And so my question would be, and I'm coming back to the community factor, first question, what can we do to move into the right direction? And what important role do communities and a collective vision that we need actually for the future play here?
Yeah. I'm envisioning optimistically that designers come to form an important community within society where they see themselves as designers as an important way of changing our society in the right direction. That we begin to think differently about design as this important process by which we change things as they are now to how it is that we want them to be, to this preferred state to use, or preferred situation to use Herb Simon's terms. That designers as a profession have this important responsibility potential impact of thinking more broadly about design as a profession. That even though we're architects or user interface designers, software designers, graphic designers, it's this broader sense of changing the world, of moving from where we are to where we want to be, that is really our mission as designers. And that the extent to which we can think about that collectively as designers across design specializations, whether it's architects or engineers or teachers or lawyers or doctors, seeing themselves as a community of people who are changing the world for the better. That's the vision that drives my work and drives my thinking. And it has to be done collectively, as you say. We can't do that individually. One of my heroes is Greta Thunberg, who is this young kid. I mean, we all have this sense of, what is it that I can do? I'm just one person. But here Greta has kind of changed the world. And it's not that she did it individually. It's she did it by creating this movement, this collective group of people who have the same vision. And it's through that kind of creation of a community and a movement that we can get from where we are to where we want to be, that we take the road less traveled rather than the one that's most mm-hmm. comfortable and is leading us down the path of unsustainability.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe yourself as hopeful that we as a society are going to figure out this problem and eventually win the battle for sustainability, even if it is only within the scope of digital design?
It depends on which day you talk to me. Ask that question. I kind of go back and forth. I mean, sometimes I look around or read the paper and I'm going like, oh, we are so screwed. other times when I'm working with specific groups or talking to people who are doing exciting things, I feel much more hopeful. That the first part of July, I'm going to a national conference in Gettysburg, which has an important significance mm-hmm. To us in the U.S. That's where Lincoln gave his Gettysburg address during the Civil War, where he was talking about the Union, which of course is what the Civil War was all about. So it's significant that it's in that location, this conference, because it's a conference for an organization called Braver Angels. And that's a case study in my book. And the mission of this group is to bridge the gap between the left and the right. Not by trying to get them to agree to it with each other, but to try and get them to understand each other. And it's through this understanding that of people who have different ways of thinking, different ideas, different values, that we can save our democracy. So it's that kind of experience that makes me hopeful, that makes me optimistic. When I see people really trying to come together, people who are at the opposite sides of an issue, trying to come together and make a difference, that I feel hopeful.
That's a wonderful answer, I would say, because I cannot agree more that we need so much more of this, right? Of people coming together, of discussing things, of finding compromises, right? Because that's something we sometimes have the feeling that we are in big danger of losing this, right? That the extreme opinions are gaining so much power and
Bob,
I think we could continue this for one or two more hours, because it's so inspiring. Really mean that to talk to you.
I appreciate that.
And
I agree. We could talk for hours there.
Yeah, maybe you have to return. Maybe you have to return one day, and we do a second episode, maybe in 1 year, and see where we have reached.
What'll be very interesting in the next year, and I'd be glad to talk about this then, is the impact that artificial intelligence has on all of this. Because on one hand it's the apocalypse, on the other hand it's going to save the world.
Where do you find yourself on that scale?
Well, Depends on which day you ask.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm writing an article on this that I'd be glad to share with you. But it'll be on LinkedIn sometime next week. It's kind of what's the impact of design going to be, or the impact of artificial intelligence going to be on the design profession? So, and the hint to answering that question is how you define design. And we've talked about that in this discussion. So, it depends on how we use it.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, perfect. We found the topic for the next episode. We would love to do with.
And
you.
We found the most UX answer. That's always fun if we can find the most UX answer possible in a podcast, which is it depends.
Yeah.
True. Hey, Bob, thank you so much for joining us here today. It was a real pleasure. As I said, really inspiring, and I really mean that. And
thank you very much, and also
an honor to have you here, with us.
Well, it has been a pleasure, and really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Really, really happy to hear that. So thank you very much, Bob. Thank you very much, all you wonderful people out there, actually, for listening to our latest episodes. And well, if you liked what you heard, please give us a subscription and a rating. We would highly appreciate. So goodbye from our side. And since the final words actually always belong to our guest, Bob, do you have any final words, a final sentence or advice to all of us that you would like to mention?
Well, you might guess, let's all go out there and make the world a better place.
The SUX podcast is brought to you by the SUX Network, a nonprofit initiative and network that drives sustainable and responsible UX based on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Hosted by Thorsten Jonas and me, Bavo Lodwex. Edited by me, Bavo. Support by Isabel Pettinato. We'll see you next time.